Today in Montreal, we've had a full political week in Canada. We're going to get to a discussion of the softwood lumber resolution. We're going to get to a discussion of the Liberal leadership race later on in the program. But we're going to begin with international and national news at a different perspective. As we face an almost imminent confrontation with Iran and as we face new threats from Islamist terror groups, we're going to be discussing a new military cooperation agreement that's just been concluded between the United States and Canada. The report has been finalized. It's been 3 years in the making. It's a report that deals with continental defense, information sharing, military cooperation. We'll see where it's going and how it's going to be acted upon. Our very special guest will be Canadian Naval Captain Richard Bergeron, who is co-director of the U.S.-Canada Planning Group in Colorado Springs. We're also going to be looking at what are reactions within Canada to the threats from Islamist groups. And here we're not talking about physical threats. We're talking about threats against our freedom of speech. We're talking about threats of against news commentators, threats against people who voice opinions. We'll have David Harris, the former director of priorities and planning for CSIS and president of Insignia Strategic Research. And from Philadelphia, Dr. Daniel Pipes, the founder and director of the Middle East Forum and the former board member of the U.S. Congress Institute for Peace, taking a look at the Council on American Islamic Relations and its Canadian cousin, the Council on American Relations Canada, CARE-CAN as it's called. At the same time, we're going to flip over to the other side and we're going to have some cautionary words that we can't mirror what we seek to destroy. In other words, in terms of this whole fight, in the worldwide fight against terror that we're involved in and all the military cooperation agreements that we're doing, our own anti-terrorism legislation, C-37, that we protect those civil liberties that we're fighting for, that make us different from the enemy abroad. And we're going to look at the dangers within. Rick McConomy, studio with me. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, day. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Montreal, we welcome your call, 790-0006, email at info@iapm.ca, and we'll be back with our first guest, Captain Richard Bergeron, right after this. Montreal, we're back. The tragic events of September 11, 2001 prompted Canadian and United States officials to discuss means of improving safety and security of citizens of both countries. One result of these discussions was the creation of a binational planning group, BPG, in 2002 with an agreement signed by the Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs and the U.S. Secretary of State. Established for a period of 2 years, it was later extended until May 2006, and the BPG's purpose was to enhance binational military planning, surveillance, and support to civilian authorities. We're privileged to have with us Canadian Naval Captain Richard Bergeron, who is co-director of the final report that just came out of the U.S.-Canada Planning Group. Welcome, Captain Bergeron.
Thank you, Mr. Wiseman. Glad to be with you this morning.
You're on a speaking tour, on a briefing tour of Canada right now, I understand. We're talking to you from Quebec City today?
No, we were in the Montreal area. We'll be in Quebec City tomorrow. We're speaking to different groups of interest with regards to defense and security issues, including Strategic Institute and academia. And as well, we've briefed government officials that were by whom we were mandated, and others who are directly involved in defense and security issues between our two countries.
Captain Bergeron, you and I have had a chance to talk about this before, and perhaps you could explain to our listeners, why did the initiative come from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as opposed to National Defense, and what were they looking for, and did it meet all the defense criteria of what we've been talking about or what we've heard about in the media as a new continental defense perimeter?
Yeah, well, initially, after the events of 9/11, the two governments and the intro you mentioned about the enhanced military cooperation agreement between our two governments at the level of Foreign Affairs and the U.S. Secretary of State. And as a result of that agreement, which had quite a broad language in affirming the merit of broadening binational defense arrangements to prevent and mitigate threats and ensure increased cooperation and well-coordinated responses to both natural disasters and a man-made event, the binational planning group was created. And what was unique about that group is it was composed of 50 U.S. and Canadian military that didn't fall under military command structure. We were mandated by state and foreign affairs, and we as part of our mandate, we're given the broad areas to look at, which in our final report is reflected by the need as a result of our finding of a continental defense and security approach and a vision that would be translated into an agreement later. And in a few words here with regards to defense and security is we see that we can't separate the two as historically we've tended to talk defense to defense and security agencies to security agencies. We need to be better coordinated and have an approach that bring those together, not necessarily integrating them, but working definitely much closer together.
One of the mandates and one of the recommendations under what you call the four pillars, which you can explain, is to prevent and is to help this the new structure prevent and mitigate threats or attacks, particularly awareness of emerging situations and surveillance activities. That seems to suggest that we need more manpower, not just cooperation between intelligence agencies. Could you expand on that a bit?
Well, as part of the pillars you mentioned, too, and how we present those issues in our final report, the four pillars were mainly in the areas of deliberate planning. We need to do more planning together to be more deliberate, vice reacting when an event happens. The other pillar had to do with information sharing, which combines information and as well intelligence, always keeping in mind, however, because that's an area where there are laws, policies that on both sides of the border that are clear about issues of privacy and that are important. And we're not advocating to stop those, but we can do a much better job within the constraint that are there through laws and policies to foster an atmosphere of more sharing by protecting information, which in our culture has tended to be
porous, to say the least.
Well, yeah, it was there, and changing a culture, it takes time, and we feel it takes direction through agreements that direct agencies and people to think more of the need to share than the protection of information. And the other two areas had to do with communication architectures. That one is one that's technically, I think technology allows improvement for that to happen, but again, it takes the will to get systems to be more compatible with each other, especially when we talk about systems that traditionally have been military focused on one end and others that are security focused. Bringing those together requires definitely a lot of work and will to make it happen. And finally, the areas of exercise and training. We can't expect to be more efficient at defending our continent, defending at both of our countries without exercising and training, and in this case, training together between our two countries, not only within military agencies, but as well security agencies. The interagency aspect of all this is all very important.
So basically you're looking at Rick McConomy in Montreal. Basically you're looking for a political will to back this particular report, which would integrate both U.S. and Canadian resources in the area of prevention. And 9/11, of course, led us to believe that there was some confusion as to who was talking to whom and what information was moving along and what information wasn't moving. Are you hoping that this is going to cover that particular set of gaps?
Well, I think, yes, I think as time evolves here, the reality of what's been happening since 9/11 has very much to do here as a result of that change of threat to from a symmetric to a symmetric threat. Internally, has very much to do with the significant change in our structures for new organizations.
Permit me to interrupt because I heard your talk on Friday, and I think it's important for our listeners to understand what you just said, the symmetric threat versus the asymmetric threat, and how you explained that the old Cold War analogies and strategies no longer work. We knew where the threat was coming from. Today's asymmetric threat is everywhere and could be a strike at any time, and that's what you meant by symmetric and asymmetric.
Yeah, the old dew line, right?
Well, that's right. And I mean, while there's still a strategic threat and you don't want to close your eyes to it, it's nowhere what it was during the Cold War. You know, you still have the North Korea issues and some proliferation that is part of our environment today.
But Captain Bergeron, just hold that thought. We'll be right back with you right after this. Montreal, we're back. We're talking with Naval Captain Richard Bergeron, who is the co-director of the new bi-national study on military cooperation between Canada and the United States. And we want to hear from you if you understand the gravity of the situation and how a new paradigm is necessary. Captain Bergeron, you were explaining before the break the difference between the old symmetric threat. We knew where the enemy was, the Cold War threat versus the new asymmetric threat, the world we're facing now of a war on terror and the necessities for new paradigms to deal with it.
Yeah, and as part of the new paradigm, it's important to, I think, realize that the reaction of both governments post 9/11 has been to stand up four different organizations, two on each side of the border, namely on the military side, the U.S. Northern Command, which has been stood up about 4 years ago, and on the Canadian side, the newly formed Canada Command, which was just stood up last 1st of February. And on the civilian side of the spectrum, the standing up in the U.S. of the Department of Homeland Security.
Was the reason for the time lapse, were we depending on the American cover, or was it because we thought we had already had sufficient agreements in place?
No, I think the whole issue here was an issue of adapting to our new environment, and the way it was perceived with the attacks having taken place in the U.S., they reacted definitely more quickly. But in Canada, adjustments were deemed necessary as well, and the standing up of Canada Command and the Public Safety Emergency Preparedness Canada, both were Canadian reactions. Now, it's important as you look at the synergy between these organizations that, first of all, nationally, we've got to find our ways in developing the right synergy to work together. And when you look at it from a binational point of view, as time evolves and the maturities of these respective organizations grows, this is what will define the future. And in the midst of that, we already had, on the military side, a long-standing command, by the way, of the North American Aerospace Defense, NORAD, that had been there since 1958.
Captain Bergeron, explain for our listeners the Canadian equivalent of the Homeland Security and whether it's up and running and at the same level.
Well, the Canadian reciprocal in terms of Public Safety Emergency Preparedness Canada was regrouping a number of agencies that fell under one department, that is called PSEPC and soon to be called Public Safety Canada.
PSEPC is Public Security and Emergency Preparedness Canada.
That's right, yeah. And these organizations are not mirror image of each other. This is what, as we look at this for the future, we've got to realize that each countries have national imperative and approach things slightly different. And even on the military side, Canada Command and U.S. Northern Command, they're not mirror image of each other. But the binational planning group, what we stress in our report, is in this new environment where now we find five key players, of which there's a number of sub-players under those, it's important and critical that we have unity of effort among ourselves. And there are issues, especially earlier we were talking about sharing of information. You know, we have great tradition of working together. For example, me as a naval officer, Navy to Navy, we've worked together for many years, and we're in sync with each other as part of our efforts of working together and mainly abroad.
And part of the effort has to be to get the civilian side more integrated and more linked one to the other. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. But the word integrated here, I think it'd be important for your listeners here as they listen to this. We do not advocate necessarily integration as full integration. We've got to look at this here holistically and looking at what are the vehicles available to us in order to ensure we have the right coordination.
Right.
This may be binational in some cases, like NORAD was. It's a binational command. Or it could be a bilateral approach between two commands, especially the two new commands, CanadaCom and U.S. Northern Command. And as part of that is, and I'd like to emphasize that one, it's important we understand unilateral approach. What does it mean in terms of national interest on both sides of the border? What is our intent nationally? Because there is no doubt as we go about this, it's a complex world out there, and we're sovereign countries. But within these constraints, We need to use human resources by way of exchange or liaison officers and systems to optimize and use all the tools available to us to get the synergy going in adapting to this environment. I may make a comparison to that in terms of adapting to, for example, the end of the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, there was it took 13 years to reach the point where we created NORAD in 1958. And if you look at how this evolved, you could compare today. I'm not suggesting here it's the same type of environment. It's very different. But in terms of the time and the level of maturity and exchange between these agencies that's required, we haven't reached an end state.
Captain Bergeron, we'd ask you to hold that thought and stay with us. We'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me, and we have the privilege of speaking to Captain Naval Captain Richard Bergeron, who's the co-director of the newly released study on enhanced military cooperation between Canada and the U.S. And Captain Bergeron, before I ask you a last question, I know your time is pressed. I want to make clear to our listening audience that this report is not just theory. The work over the past 3 years has created a basic new defense paradigm with coordination in place for a combined defense plan as well as a civil assistance plan in case of binational emergencies. It's introduced a Canadian forces presence right in the U.S. Northern Command Joint Operations Center. It's created a binational document library which finally brought together all the agreements and documents relating to Canada-U.S. defense and security. And fourthly, it's already enhanced shared strategic maritime awareness and warning between Canada and the U.S. And that intelligence is so vital because most terrorists and most threats to our public security actually come in as much through ports as through airports. And Captain Bergeron, just a final question to you. How do you respond? I mean, I know how I would respond, but how do you respond? And it must be frustrating to hear from a lot of the Canadian knee-jerk anti-Americanism that anything Canada does with the United States must be ipso facto bad. And you get that at the political level and you get that at the media level. What should people understand about this new agreement?
I think the key message here that people need to understand that the work that we've been doing in the binational planning group over the last 3 years, you've highlighted some of those plans we've developed. It's to simply get the two countries better prepared and more deliberate in approaching any event that may come our way, whether it be a natural disaster or a man-made disaster. And the initiatives that we've taken here, and we were tasked to develop plans. These plans, some of them will come into effect later on during this year, are all defensive in nature. And while our two countries on some front and some opinions that may be polarized one way or another, we may not agree between our two countries on some aspects, I think we need to, for the sake of the citizen of both of our countries, put those aside, because I don't think when we talk about security of our people and looking after their well-being, saving lives, minimizing suffering, and mitigating risk, we're not getting any pushback on those issues, because it's about maintaining the stability we enjoy between our two countries, because one of the key center of gravity there is our economic interdependence, and we want to be in a position, and from military planners' point of view, to ensure that we are prepared.
And we're all the North American target, right? We are the North American target, Canada, the United States.
Well, we live in a global world, and when you just look at the amount of trade between our two countries, and those are part of the seams and gaps here that can be exploited.
Absolutely.
You know, if the border was to be closed, you know, they because of an event, well, they are a significant impact to that. And we're working at developing plans that will minimize effect of whatever comes our way, whether it be a disaster, natural, or man-made.
Captain Richard Bergeron, thank you very much for joining us. You've done a great service to this country, and we wish you best of luck on your tour.
Thank you very much.
Keep up the good fight.
Okay, bye-bye.
Montreal, we'll be back right after this, and we want to hear from you on whether you understand the importance of this work that's just been described. We've just finished talking to Canadian Naval Captain Richard Bergeron, co-director of the new Canada-U.S. Military Cooperation Agreement, about the external threats to Canada and the United States, external threats from terror, from terrorism, from dirty bombs, from weaponry. But sometimes there's an even more insidious threat, and that's the threat that comes from within. It comes from organizations that seek to quiet freedom of speech. That comes from excessive political correctness where we're afraid to speak the truth. And we want to examine one of these dangers within with two remarkable guests. Joining us from Ottawa is David Harris, former director of priorities and planning for CSIS and president of Insignia Strategic Research. And joining us from Philadelphia is Dr. Daniel Pipes, founder and director of Middle East Forum and a former board member of the U.S. Congress Institute for Peace, where he was appointed by President Bush. Just for some background, David Harris, together with David Frum, nationally syndicated columnist, together with an American by the name of Andrew Whitehead, were sued by the Council on American-Islamic Relations simply for questioning what its activities are, on the one hand, and in David Harris's case, simply for raising a question on CFRA radio in Ottawa as to whether the connections between CAIR CAN, and CAIR US should be examined. This past week, for a variety of reasons, which we'll get into with Mr. Harris and Dr. Pipes, CAIR dropped all its lawsuits. And we want to start off with a little background on this. Welcome, David Harris. Welcome, Daniel Pipes. Thank you for taking time out on a Sunday to be with us.
Thanks, Carol.
Good afternoon, both of you.
David, perhaps we start with you. What happened with this lawsuit? All you said on CFRA radio, which was also sued, you merely asked a question, should not the relationship between CARE CAN and CARE US be examined?
Yeah, maybe I should roll back a bit. I mean, the context was, of course...
I'm sorry, gentlemen, if one of you has a radio on or something, would you shut it off? Go ahead, David.
Okay, the context was that I was concerned about the Washington-based Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, as it calls itself. CARE has had, to put it mildly, an uneven history in the United States. Its founders have been profoundly closely associated with an organization called the Islamic Association of Palestine, the IAP. And this organization has been described by a number of retired FBI, former counterterrorism people, as a Hamas front. We've seen former significant personalities with U.S. CARE charged and convicted of terror-related offenses, including a charming fellow by the name of Randall Todd Royer, who I think was the bane of Dr. Pipe's existence for a spell, who was a convert to Islam, absolutely charmed the media, was some kind of human rights coordinator for the U.S. CARE organization, and was convicted of weapons and explosives charges ultimately. So there were all kinds of deeply troubling features about the U.S. CARE organization. Then into the front of things in the Canadian context comes something called the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE CAN, as it's called. And I noticed that CARE CAN was receiving an awful lot of attention. Its former chair was getting a monthly column in the Globe and Mail. And by and large, its influence was spreading. There were parliamentary subcommittees giving it audiences. So my question simply was, in light of all of these deeply troubling features of the American organization, I wanted to know what exactly was the nature of the relationship between the American CARE and the Canadian organization. For that, I got sued.
For that, you got sued with the station. Now, Daniel Pipes, you've been described as the preeminent source of information on Islamist groups, on terror threats. You've briefed everybody from the president to senators to members of Congress. Can you give us some background on CARE US?
The organization was founded in 1994, as David Harris indicated, by individuals who had been prior associated with the Islamic Palestine.
Sorry, Dan, if you could speak a little closer to your phone.
Sure. With that, 1994, by individuals who had been closely associated with Islamic Association for Palestine, which is widely understood to be a Hamas front. It has been in operation now for some 12 years, and through that time has engaged in a campaign of intimidation of critics, privileging for Islam and Muslims, and generally spreading the Islamist, the radical Islamic message quite effectively in the United States and in Canada. It has some 31 branches, including the one in Toronto. And it has a multi-million dollar budget. It has great access to the media. It has been working with law enforcement and with public schools, with a whole range of establishment institutions. And my effort has been designed to bring the attention of individuals who don't know otherwise, or institutions, that this is an extremist organization that, among other things, has ties to terrorism. But in the long term, I think the real danger of such a group, as you indicated in your introductory remarks, is not so much terrorism as it is changing the nature, changing the public sphere, so that those of us who want to discuss issues freely cannot do so because CARE and its ilk have closed down the public discourse.
Daniel Pipes, David Harris, please stay with us. We'll be back with you right after this. David Harris in Ottawa. Both you and Dan Pipes have alluded to the terrorist affiliations of CARE in the United States. Can you elaborate a bit on the specifics before we get back to these cases that were dropped?
Well, I guess, I indicated the issue of Randall Todd Royer. He was a fellow who was charged and convicted with weapons and explosives and was a significant part of the U.S., the Washington-based CARE organization. But there have been others, and there have been connections of others in that organization alleged to Hamas. We've seen that they even extended to a very senior person, Marzouk.
Now, we understand a lot of these allegations are backed up by evidence from intelligence services. Is that not correct?
Certainly, former FBI counterterrorism personnel have stated publicly that they see these connections and are comfortable declaring that they exist.
Now, David Frum, National Post columnist, he was sued, I believe a bit after you were, simply for suggesting that CARE CAN had terrorist affiliations. And that suit was dropped as well. No apologies, no explanations, no nothing.
Well, he made some other assertions, but let me just, in fairness, make it clear that there are no charges or convictions against people associated with the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, and
correct.
Nobody suggested any direct terrorist involvement. It's a more subtle issue, as an issue for genuine questions, and as Dr. Pipe said, real discourse, not censored discourse.
Has it contorted the freedom of discussion, the open freedom of discussion about what are legitimate and what are illegitimate organizations and the views they propagate?
I think it certainly has, because any kind of libel suit, especially in Canadian jurisdictions, tends to impose silence on the defendant. And when that happens, then you have a kind of double censorship, where the person being sued is holding his peace, is keeping quiet, and all others around see the message in this and themselves don't want to embark on any related discussion.
You got pretty good support from CFRA when the suit was launched against you. They kept you on as an analyst. You appeared regularly.
That was one of the funniest aspects, actually, in the long run. We noticed a press release issued by the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations rather boasting that I appeared no longer to be in use as a CFRA consultant on-air person. And, of course, that was completely wrong, and I can only imagine who might have lost their job over that at CARE Canada headquarters.
So we can conclude from this that there's some kind of a use of the Canadian legal system, an abuse of the censorship system, and an attempt to cut the debate short when anyone makes allegations that come close to the associations we're talking about between the U.S. and Canadian connection for CARE CAN.
Well, it does raise itself as an issue, and what's all the more puzzling is that a document was turned up that was an affidavit sworn out for Ontario Superior Court by Dr. Shima Khan, the then chair of the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations. And this document says explicitly, and I quote, under the terms of license, CARE United States has direct control over the character and quality of all activities of CARE Canada, including the use of its trademark and trade name. So,
and yet she claimed otherwise when the suit was launched against you.
Well, it was...
Well, that was one of the things that she objected to in what you said.
Certainly there was great emphasis placed by the other side on the unique and distinct nature of the Canadian office from the American one.
And, of course, it's no accident that all of these lawsuits get dropped at the same time.
Well, that's what's extraordinary, isn't it?
What was the event that sparked that? The suit against you, very briefly, we'll come back with you after the break, but the suit against you, against David Frum, against Andrew Whitehead in the United States, who heads Anticare. Was there one thing that sparked that?
I think a few things, and one of them was a major demand for disclosure of information and documents on the part of Andrew Whitehead in the course of defending his $1.35 million lawsuit against U.S. Care.
David Harris, please stay with us. We'll be back with you right after this. Well, Joe, we're back. Beryl Wiseman, Institute for Public Affairs, Rick McConomy with me, McConomy & Associates. Want to hear from you, 790-0006, or by email, info@iapm.ca. And we're discussing the intimidation that certain Islamist groups, or groups that are sympathetic to Islamist causes, are inflicting on Canadian media and our Canadian freedom of speech. And we're talking to David Harris, from Ottawa, former director of priorities and planning for CSIS and president of Insignia Strategic Research, who was sued by CARE CAN. Now, that's not C-A-R-E. That's the Council on American Islamic Relations Canada, for merely suggesting that certain ties between CARE CAN and U.S. CARE be looked into. That lawsuit against David Harris, as well as lawsuits against David Frum, the national columnist, as well as against Andrew Whitehead, head of U.S. Anticare, were all dropped last week. David, what is the implications of them just dropping the suits, walking away, no apologies from anybody, no nothing?
Well, I mean, it means that they have to, I suppose, continue to live with what they've portrayed as the accusations that were made against them. In my case, as I say, it was really a series of questions, albeit pointed questions, but they chose to interpret those questions as suggesting, based on their statement of claim, that I was somehow connecting them with terrorism, connecting the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations with terrorism.
And that was almost a strategic mistake on their part, or a tactical mistake, because they were expanding your views beyond where you were going with it.
Oh, yes, yes. And so it turned into a catastrophe for them, I should think, in the end, because now we have in the public domain the statement of claim, which has their interpretation of my words with this dramatic kind of quality about it, and they're out there, and they didn't pursue me on to trial. So I don't know where that leaves them in terms of the public perception.
David, can we learn anything from the Rick McConomy? I'm a practicing attorney with 35 years of practice, and it's always interesting to me in libel cases. Were there some indication in the court costs? Did they assume court costs when they withdrew, or was it just a saw-off?
It was a saw-off, so they had to swallow all of their court costs.
Right.
On top of everything else. But can I raise one other really, really important point? This has got crucial implications for our rights and freedoms and indeed for any other similar event. Through this whole period, while a number of us, as you've heard, were fighting for our most basic rights and freedoms in this country and elsewhere, what do we find but a number of important institutions, including law enforcement ones, actually engaged in outreach to the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations and other organizations. And that can that may have something to be said for it in some respects, but it is rather undermining of those of us who are in the midst of the kind of struggle we are in to find, as an example, that the RCMP, National Security Community Outreach Office, had engaged with the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations in outreach, even having a senior member of the organization on their community advisory board to advise, presumably, RCMP officers about Muslim sensibility.
Unbelievable.
Now, this can be disheartening if you are fighting for charter rights at the same time. And I had the extraordinary experience just a few weeks ago of having had a representative of that RCMP, National Security Community Outreach Group, in a classroom, a class I was giving at Carleton University. And this person was actually citing statistics from CARE giving them all the credibility that one would derive as an organization from being referred to authoritatively by the RCMP.
David Harris, we thank you for being with us, but we thank you more for standing up for what we Canadians value as our preeminent right, and that is the freedom of thought and the freedom of expression. And you were out there, and you had a lot of friends supporting you, and we hope that that's the kind of country we want to build together.
And many good, courageous Muslims were backing us up, too, I might add.
Excellent. Keep fighting the good fight, David.
Thanks a lot, Beryl. Thanks a lot.
Montreal will be back right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. And we've been talking today about mutual defense agreements between Canada and the United States, the dangers of organizations like CARE-CAN and the enemy within and the enemy without. It's important now to turn to the other side of the coin. All this work that's being done, all the efforts that we're doing, the key thing is never to mirror what we're seeking to destroy, never to compromise those essential civil liberties that define us as a country. And the conservative justice package that was recently tabled has in it items of major concern, and we're very honored to be joined today by Alan Borovoy, the General Counsel to the Canadian Civil Liberty Association. Alan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I guess the first thing in the package that's really troublesome and that's caused a lot of discussion is this question of mandatory minimums. And we wrote on this back in March 2005, and correct me if I'm wrong, but did the debate start soon after the murder of those four RCMP officers in Alberta? Is that when this issue started to creep out again?
This issue comes up time and again when some awful crime is committed. Somebody starts talking about mandatory minimums as though that's going to solve the problem and everything will be nice thereafter. As a matter of fact, I think that probably the most recent is during the Boxing Day in Toronto, there was an awful shooting. Young girl lost her life.
Yeah.
And immediately, politicians began again to shout for mandatory minimum sentences.
It's pandering.
I think it's very much pandering. I think that what you're dealing with is an attempt to use a simplistic solution to address complex reality.
Many security officials, both local and federal, that we've talked to recently have said exactly that, and this off the record, they want to go on the air, but they said it's not mandatory minimums that we need. What we need is more budgets, and what we need are more visible visible cops on the street, and we don't have the budgets for it.
Yes. Well,
In other words, they're saying we have enough law to do the job.
Oh, for sure. The whole thing is really silly. But it's not just that it's silly. It's also that it's terribly dangerous. I want to give you, of course, the classic example. There is a man now, he's been languishing in jail for about 4 years or so, and he's got more to do. I'm talking about Robert Latimer, the Saskatchewan farmer who ended the life of his disabled daughter. The trial judge who heard all the evidence and the jury who heard all the evidence wanted a more lenient outcome. But because of the nature of the charge that had been laid against him, they couldn't do it. It carries a mandatory minimum sentence, and that happens to be life with no chance of parole for 10 years. He was charged with second-degree murder. And what you have, and the judge said that the man, that Mr. Latimer did this out of love and compassion for his daughter. Now, for the most part, second-degree murderers are committed for greed, for malice. That's usually the motive.
Right.
And if you just to summarize what's happened, you have a situation now, the awful spectacle of a compassionate father getting punished the same as if he were a malevolent robber.
Isn't there a trend across the board, those Rick McConomy, Alan, a trend across the board to try and eliminate judicial discretion and the ability to make those exceptions and to recognize the Robert Latimer cases?
Of course. Well, that's, of course, what mandatory minimums do. And, you know, just to flip it back the other way, if I may, I'd like to give you one more example. A few years ago, the Ontario Court of Appeal reduced some fellow's sentence from 1 year to 6 months. He had discharged a weapon with intent to wound or something. I forget exactly what. Now, they reduced the sentence from a year to 6 months. They said they did it because of his record of excellent service to the community and because he was in a situation of high stress, which required split-second decision-making. He happened to be a police officer. And he was chasing a burglar, and he thought too quickly and committed this offense. Now, the interesting thing is, there you have a guy who wound up with 6 months in jail. Today, that same police officer would have to serve 4 years for that. And I would suspect that even the proponents of mandatory minimums would not be very happy with an outcome like that. But that's what happens when you have this foolish, stupid rigidity built into the system.
Montreal, we'll be back with Alan Borovoy, General Counsel of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, right after this break. And 790-0006, we'd like to hear your opinion on mandatory minimums. 790-0006, we'll be back right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. Our special guest, General Counsel of the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, Alan Borova, on the line from Toronto. We're discussing mandatory minimums and the federal government's new omnibus justice bill.
Alan, I wanted to ask you, is there a tendency among juries, do you think, to start to, like, stretch the definition of the crime, knowing that there's a minimum sentence coming? A little like along the lines of the O.J. Simpson thing.
As a matter of fact, there was some research commissioned by the Federal Justice Department which found that there was some empirical evidence to suggest that juries may be less likely to convict if they know that there is a mandatory minimum sentence at the end of the line.
Not only
do you risk an unjust sentence, but you also run some risk to public safety with these stupid laws.
You end up with an absolute acquittal, which puts the person back on the street instead of having a sentence somewhere between zero and the minimum and maximum minimum.
Of course.
Alan, I want to take you back to one of your examples that you gave, which was the Latimer case.
Mm-hmm.
One of your staff members told me that you have a great line that says, "Our defeats are only the victories we haven't yet won." Yet where do people sympathetic to civil liberties?
I have to get you to say that differently.
Tell me.
A victory is a defeat we haven't yet won.
Perfect. Even better. A victory is a defeat we haven't yet won.
I'm sorry. A defeat is a victory we haven't yet won.
So that's what I said.
This is the Stanley Cup playoffs are on now. We better get this clear. A defeat is a victory we haven't yet won.
You got words right. You just didn't get the emphasis.
There we go. Thank you.
All right.
Where do people... We're cognizant of civil liberties and cognizant of the threat of civil liberties. Where do we go for alliances? Where are we heard? Where can we be heard, particularly since you have the Liberal Party and the NDP piling on this bill in apparent agreement? You have Erwin Cotler, the former justice minister, who a year ago was looking at the decriminalization of suicide, which would have been the Latimer case. Then he opposed the idea of mandatory minimums when they came up at the time of the...
The Latimer case was not a suicide. So I don't think we should mislead. It was not a suicide. Look, politicians, without my particularly commenting on Kotler or anyone else. Politicians often feel the squeeze when there is something very unpopular that's just occurred, and there's some kind of a campaign of this kind. The politicians feel squeezed by it.
Quick solution.
Well, there are no quick solutions, but of course, I think I can testify that you were not primed to ask that question, at least as far as I'm concerned. And this is my opportunity to say to people, if this kind of thing bothers you, please join the Canadian Civil Liberties Association.
What's your number?
It's in Toronto. It's 416-363-0321.
And we would encourage everybody to do just that. Alan, most of European countries don't even have this concept of mandatory minimums anymore. It's been proven to be ineffective in most of the Western jurisdictions, has it not?
I'm not able to tell you that. I haven't done enough work on what goes on elsewhere. I'm having enough trouble keeping up with what's going on in Canada.
Well, speaking about what's going on in Canada, is this another element of a culture of control that we've seen in the past year and a half, with laws regulating everything up to and including our email traffic? And how do we roll this back? How do we limit it where it's going?
Well, there are no easy answers to that. But the name of the game is public pressure. Citizens who feel strongly about these things have to complain. Interestingly enough, with the Latimer case in particular, a poll found that some 70% rather of Canadians favored a more lenient outcome for Robert Latimer. We had some 60,000 signatures on a petition that we and a number of others circulated across the country. There's no question that that's where public opinion is, but it has to be mobilized to speak up.
But public opinion is a difficult thing. You don't make justice policies based on public opinion because it could swing one or another. But to bring this conversation down to street level, I want to share a file that we had at the Institute and how these mandatory minimum regulations, even, never mind sentences, what they mean in everyday life. There was the Patriot Act in the United States calls on judges not to exercise any discretion when a foreign national is stopped for a felony or a misdemeanor. They are to be sent to relocation camps and then sent back to their country of origin. And we had a case of a young fella, graduated school, took a motorcycle trip down California. Highway patrolman stopped him, found a joint. He spent 3 months in detention until they can get him back here, just because the system is so strained. There were 14,000 people in California alone caught under this mandatory rule in the Patriot Act.
I'm not in a position to comment on the American situation because I really don't know it that well. But what you are describing, at least in general terms, is the problem that you face. We know that reality is very complicated, and if you try to deal with it by way of a simplistic solution, you're going to run into trouble, because there's just no way that with a minimum sentence you can reasonably anticipate the wide variety of problems as they arise in human society. And that's why we have judges, to try to deal more sensitively with these things. It just doesn't make sense. And if I could turn it around the other way, for the greatest number of situations, sentences can be appealed. You can get more than one shot at it. But if you're dealing with a mandatory minimum, rigidity is built into the system. There's nowhere else you can go, no matter how compelling the circumstances might be.
Rigorous law is often rigorous injustice.
Well, that's what's so unjust and improper about that.
Alan Borovoy, General Counsel of Canadian Civil Liberties Association, thank you very much for joining us today and taking time out from your Sunday. And I just want you to repeat once more, for Canadians of conscience, for Canadians who are bothered by issues like this, they call 1-416-363-0321.
Good. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Alan, thank you,
thanks
Alan.
Very much.
Thank you.
Montreal will be right back. An item of good news on the national agenda this week. We finally had a settlement of the softwood lumber dispute with the United States. The only people who are probably sad about it are the writers who have been grinding out this as grist for their mill. And to talk about this and other aspects of our foreign policy, we were very pleased to welcome back Ontario Senator Consiglio Danino. Con, thanks for taking time out on Sunday.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Con. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure.
During the campaign, Prime Minister Harper, of course, pushed his 5 points, and they were mostly domestic agenda series of points. But we've seen him since taking office restore Canadian pride in our foreign policy when on the Hamas position, revive Canadian purpose when he went to Kandahar, and now he's restored a pragmatism that's been missing from our foreign policy. Where did this foreign policy aspect or affect of the Harper administration come from? Because we didn't hear about it during the campaign, and it's refreshing.
Well, I'm not sure we didn't hear about the campaign. He's often referred to ever since he became the leader of the Conservative Party, and during the campaign probably didn't put the focus on it that he did in the five-point plan. But he's talked about the relationship with the Americans. I mean, the Americans take, 87-89% of our trade. We stop trading. We're going to go hungry. He's always said that he's going to build a better relationship. But I think that's at least partially, and I think in large part, the thing that's responsible for the settlement. Sure, there's been going on for the last year and a half, discussions on the issue. But you have to be friendly to be able to sit down at a table and say, all right, let's strike a deal.
And you have to put together the right team also, which he did.
Of course, Michael Wilson is one of the most respected, I call him Mr. Integrity, one of the most respected politicians in Canada, now respected as a businessman. And he was there before. He was part of the team that negotiated the FTA. And here we are. He was able to add his value and his relationships to solve this problem, which has been going on, by the way, for over 100 years.
Con Danino, we have to take a short break, and we'll be right back with you. Montreal, we're back. We're talking to Senator Consiglio Danino of Ontario on the softwood lumber agreement and generally the Prime Minister's very successful foreign policy. Con, I have one question. There's generally been a tradition at Foreign Affairs, at the Department of Foreign Affairs, of almost a knee-jerk anti-Americanism. It looks like this Prime Minister is reining in a lot of those policies and directing a lot of traffic directly out of the PMO. Am I right in viewing that?
Well, that's only part of it. The other part is that there has been an anti-American sentiment in the government for the past 13 years.
Yes, there has.
And I think... not necessarily Martin, but Chrétien, Mr. Chrétien, the previous prime minister, certainly had showed some strong anti-American positions in the past. Mr. Martin did not change that. He didn't do much to improve it. And I think that's, of course, reflected in the folks who work for them, which, of course, is the foreign affairs people. I can tell you that it's not... universal, my feeling is that it's mainly been from the leadership, the political leadership. When we see Carolyn Parrish allowed to stump on an effigy of the president, I mean, that's just totally unacceptable.
Doesn't make any sense. Con, would you, Rick McConomy, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks.
Super. Why don't give our listeners a bit of a feeling for what was the softwood lumber deal that was cut and how it impacts on the Canadian economy itself.
Well, we don't know the details. Let me first of all say that it seems like this is one of those perfect business solutions. My background is business. I was in the financial services sector for 4 decades. And when you have an...
Con, you're only 35 years old.
That's true. Thank you for that. When you have an issue as difficult as that, and you sit down, the solution usually that is the right solution is when both sides go home a little unhappy, and it certainly seems that that's what happened here. Now, we don't know all the details, but it certainly appears as if we have a 7-year deal, which will return about 80% of the funds that have been collected by the Americans in duties for the past little while, tariffs, and will... will cap the Canadian exports to the Americas, or to, I'm sorry, to the U.S. At 34%, 36%, 35%. BC had a bit of a problem with some of the details on some of the internal BC lumber producers, and that seems to have been resolved in creating some flexibility, but we actually don't have the details of this. And I suspect that there's still going to be some bumps along the road to deal with some of the issues that will come up when you look at the details. You know, the old saying, the devil is always in the details, but the most important thing is the will is there. The commitment to cut a deal which will make people relatively happy.
And the gestures are right? The reimbursement of the 80% and the...
And one of the most important things for Quebec is that the baseline and the quotas will not be on an 18-month averaging, but on a 4-year averaging, which is very important.
Those are the details that haven't yet been seen. I mean, these are little snippets of things that we're reading from folks who seem to know something, but I think we have to take a close look at the details. But, you know, frankly, as I said, I think we're going to see some bumps along the road when we see those things, but it'll be on both sides. And once the goodwill is there, the deal will be made.
Well, it certainly looks like Canadian foreign policy is moving in a refreshing new direction, and we have high hopes in this administration. Con Danino, thanks for taking time out to be with us this Sunday.
My pleasure, Barrow, anytime, and good luck.
Thanks, care.
Thanks, Con.
Ciao.
Montreal will be right back after this to discuss the Liberal leadership race. Montreal, we're back with Rick McConomy in studio with me. Just a word, we've had several callers who wanted to know what happened to Daniel Pipes. Unfortunately, his cell phone went dead and he was calling from the airport. So that was the reason why the interview continued with David Harris.
We're continuing with a conspiracy theory on that particular.
Richard?
Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
There's no conspiracy theory. We're going to have 1,000 callers now. Our final guest today is our good friend Angelo Persicelli, one of the finest political columnists in the country, writes for the Hill Times.
Hello, Angelo. How are you doing?
And Angelo... How are you? Thanks for taking time out on a Sunday.
It's my pleasure.
Angelo, this Liberal leadership race. What is this? They're all reading from the same script. They're effervescent. They're excited. We have to discover ourselves. What are these guys politicians, or are they you know, romper room?
Do the Liberals need a goalie? Or didn't they have the greatest goalie in the world? Like they took an investigation to investigate themselves and found that no other people were in the thing and everyone else was at fault.
Well, considering that we have 10 and maybe 2 more might come next week.
Oh, right. God.
Definitely it's something different from any other leadership race. How many of them will stick to the end, it's hard to say, but definitely this says, of course, if you talk to them, they say that this is a big opportunity and a huge undertaking and whatever. The fact of the matter is that they are quite confused. They don't know which direction are going or they want to go. And the fact that there are so many people confirms that basically they don't have the candidate they are looking for, and they are basically encouraging everybody to run.
Angelo, I don't know, is there a they that there anymore? Or are they
well, that's the point. That's the point. And that was coming to this point when, and you know, we have to talk also about our colleagues and the media, and this is the story that I'm writing, I think it's already out on the Hill Times. When they make up, they say that this is a leadership race based on ideas and policy and programs, but when we look at ourselves, at the media, we have Team A, Team B, they are talking about homecoming. They are basically, they are saying that it's a leadership race that it's based on the media, on issues and programs, but already they have Team A, Team B, and front runners. Now, based on what
style over substance.
I don't know.
Style over substance.
And I make some points too in the story. You know, when we look at, for example, there are many pundits that are saying, well, Scott Bryson, Team A, and Mauricio Bevilacqua, Team B. And I'm wondering why. What's the difference between the two?
I think we're in the me generation. Like, there's no they. Like, they set this up. It's more like, me, I want to go. Give it to me.
Well, you know, when we say they, that they are looking, they are talking about the new faces. But when we look at but the people talking about new faces, the only thing they are looking for a new face to put the usual known people behind this new face.
Are these campaigns going to be able to hold it together? I mean, after all, it takes a lot of money to mount a campaign, never mind the $50,000 to the party, but just to mount the campaign, do these people have the wherewithal?
Well, they are saying that they put the limit of $4 million. If there are 10 candidates, they need $40
million. Yeah, it's a lot of money sloshing around.
You know. So it's a smoke and mirror of what really is going to happen. People with $700-800 million, they can do the race. There are many of them will not be even able to be represented in some of the riding.
Are we going to find out where all of the money comes from for these $4 million limits?
Oh yeah.
Well, this would be interesting because when we talk about the money, officially, yes, no corporation can give money, and private individuals can give not more than, I think, $5,000, whatever. But they will find a way to let the money arrive. But
be hundreds of thousands of people.
As we were saying before, there is no money. Where are they going to get the money? Because even if at the end of the day only 6 or 7 will end up being on the last list on December the 3rd there in Montreal, how much money they can raise? And we don't have, we have also...
Besides the fact of the money, you know, it's the old question of where's the beef. I think, you know, maybe McConomy and I should run for leader and president of the party and restore some substance.
Well,
but this is going to unfold very interestingly over the next few months. And Angelo, we're out of time. I know you're in transit, and we're going to have you on again and again and again on this issue as we follow the race.
Enjoy the weekend.
Angelo, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Angelo. It's always a very interesting talking with you.
Montreal, we'll be back with you next week. I want to thank Val Prudnikoff, our producer, Chris Smith, our technical operator. Rick, well done. Montreal, see you next time.